This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Earlier this month, the National Climate Assessment was released, and the results are not good. On page one, the report says, climate change, once considered an issue for a distant future, has moved firmly into the present. With that move comes the need to respond. Here in the Northeast, says the assessment, we must adapt to heat waves, more extreme precipitation events, and coastal flooding due to sea level rise and storm surge. Now, yesterday on NPR's Morning Edition, Hoboken, New Jersey Mayor Don Zimmer gave a realistic but optimistic perspective on what we face right now.
I mean, we have an opportunity that, you know, it was impossible for other species. I mean, so it really is about adapting. I'm sure the dinosaur, if they could have predicted the ice age coming and observed it and developed a plan, they would have done that, but they couldn't do that. We can do this. We can adapt, and we must adapt. We see it in Hoboken. We are, and Weehawken and Jersey City, we're living with climate change right now. We've had, again, four major flood events. So that means people's cars are totaled, people's homes are still, you know, getting flooded, and we're seeing it on a regular basis, these heavy downpours. So, and to a certain extent, the climate change assessment report that just came out reaffirms what I know we absolutely have to do. This is a number one priority for me as the mayor of Hoboken, that this is the biggest challenge that our city is facing. We are living with this now, and we need to figure out a way to live with water.
Like New Jersey, Connecticut must also figure out how to live with water. Today, where we live, now that climate change is here, how do we adapt? Today at 1 and 8 p.m., the Colin McEnroe Show will have a panel of meteorologists to discuss the changing weather patterns and how these meteorologists view climate change through the lens of an ever-changing weather map. I hope you can join us for that conversation. Later this hour, we'll talk about the effects of climate change on infectious disease and even maple syrup production in Vermont. But first, let me welcome into studio Adam Welchel, who's Director of Science for the Nature Conservancy in Connecticut. He oversees the Coastal Resilience Network, and he was also a lead author on the Northeast section of the U.S. National Climate Assessment. Adam, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John.
If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. If you've read this assessment yourself, what are your thoughts about the ways we are adapting to climate change? 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org. Or you can send us a tweet at Where We Live. Adam, you were one of the lead authors on the Northeast section of this report. Can you walk us through some of the major points and some of the key messages, especially for this part of the world?
Yeah, the National Climate Assessment is probably one of the most rigorous and transparent scientific evaluations of climate-related impacts, vulnerabilities, and opportunities across about 19 different sectors and 8 regions in the United States, including the Northeast. It's something that's coming out. It was mandated through the Global Change Research Act of 1990, coming out of the George H.W. Bush White House. And really, this is the third national climate assessment. There was another one in 2000 and 2009. And this one was important in the sense that it was over 300 experts, not just climate scientists, but people who are actually engaged on the ground trying to figure this out, as the mayor of Hoboken referenced in her opening remarks there. And really, the key objective of the National Climate Assessment is to better inform Americans as to how they make choices about investments, where we build, where we live, and how we create safer and more resilient communities alongside conserving our ecosystems that sustain us. And I can tell you from personal experience as the lead author on the Northeast section that this was truly a significant achievement, and we need to be thanking the Global Change Research Program, really thanking them and congratulating them on this groundbreaking report.
And I want to get into some more specifics about the Northeast, but first let me ask you a little bit about how the assessment has changed over time. As you say, the need for this dates back to the H.W. Bush administration, and obviously, as we heard at the very top of our program, when Bill Clinton talked about climate change back in 1997, there was maybe one set of thoughts about how quickly it's coming and how much it's going to change. And by now, things have seemingly altered quite a bit. How much change have we seen? How much different is this report from prior reports?
Yeah, there's a couple distinct differences between this report and the first and second in 2000 and 2009, respectively. One of the key things here is that through that mandate I referenced, this is going to be a sustained effort. The other reports are kind of one-offs, but this will be a sustained effort that will be every 4 or 5 years coming out. And You know, in a very short period of time, we've really developed a huge body of knowledge that's really based on a lot of empirical information about trends in rainfall patterns, sea level rise, heat, and elements that we're paying attention to. But I think that the key message that's a little bit different or is substantially different in the third National Climate Assessment is the fact that, you know, it's not a future issue. It's here now. We're experiencing it. We're dealing with those extreme weather events, and it's, you know, there's a real opportunity here to embrace these kind of changes, but think forward about opportunities because we really have to. It's not an if; it's a now.
In just a moment, we'll be bringing in a colleague of yours from Yale University. Something that we've talked about on the show before is some of the great work that Yale and others have done in trying to gauge public opinion about this. When you talk about the message getting through and people saying this is something that is happening right now and people responding to this assessment, we're also faced with the reality that when asked, many people in America either don't believe climate change is happening, don't know what climate change is, or if they do believe both those things and know both those things, they don't put it anywhere near the top of their list of the things that they would vote about or care about. Why is that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a great question, John. And I think, you know, what's pointed out in the Northeast section of the National Climate Assessment is that we've had a few teachable moments. Back to March 2010 with a 500-year rain event. You can look at Lee and Irene, which was about 25 inches in a two-month period. You can look at the winter storms with Nemo, and you can focus in on the $60 to $80 billion price tag of an event such as Sandy. And you know, if that's not a wake up call and is compelling people to think forward about what the implications are, living through those impacts today, I don't know what is. But I will say that just to kind of give you a metric related to the National Climate Assessment. The 2 days, within 48 hours of it actually being released, there were 250,000 hits and downloads on the globalchange.gov website. So I think people are really starting to pay attention to it because it's an opportunity to avoid future costs, whether you're in the private sector, in the public sector, federal, state, local governments, citizens, residents in municipalities here in Connecticut. I think it's smart. You know, it's the way to be thinking forward a little bit.
If you have thoughts or questions about climate change and how we are adapting, how resilient we are, especially in the Northeast, we'd love to hear from you. 860-275-7266. You can also email wherelive at WNPR.org. We'd like to hear your tweets at wherelive as well. Adam Welchel joins us. He's Director of Science for the Nature Conservancy in Connecticut. I want to welcome in Alexander Felsen, who's an urban ecologist, an assistant professor in Yale's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, and also at the Yale School of Architecture. We're going to be talking about building more resilient structures here to adapt to climate change. Alexander, welcome to our show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, John.
I first of all would just like to ask you to maybe give your top line thoughts about the Northeast part of this climate assessment. What are the things that you think we need to be paying most close attention to?
Well, building on the conversation about, you know, whether people are paying attention to this, why they aren't prioritizing this, I think one of the concerns that we realized with Sandy and with some of the recent storm events is that this is a large area that's being impacted, and it's impacting homeowners, it's impacting infrastructure, it's impacting sanitary systems, it's impacting a wide range of ecosystems. And so given the range of impacts and the potential tremendous cost that we've seen, I think what people are starting to realize is, hey, we need to pay attention to this situation. We need to think about and recognize some of the trends or patterns that we're seeing. For example, salt water entering into their well systems or sanitary systems failing, local egress issues with flooding, you know, and start to realize that we need to get ahead of the game and start thinking strategically for our towns and municipalities about how to take advantage of funding that may be coming through and how to collectively work towards some kind of solutions that can be efficient and strategic at the same time, because these are big ticket items, very costly. And so you know, there's I think in the Northeast there's potential for innovation. There are a lot of development areas along the coast that face risk. There are some precedents that have been being proposed or shown or built, but a lot more is happening, I would say, in the South, Chesapeake Bay area, North Carolina, and those areas. And I think we need to learn from those and recognize the potential opportunities or solutions that we might be able to develop, even looking internationally.
But why is that? Why do you think that we've been slower to adapt than maybe some places to the south of us?
I mean, there's a tradition, I think, in the Northeast, a history, a longer history, and a connection to the land and the coast. It's multi-generational. People feel like they belong there, and it's that makes a lot of sense. I mean, in many ways, you know, we do. It's a wonderful cultural history that runs along the coast of Connecticut, New York, New Jersey. I think people are reluctant to leave because the coastal areas are embody people's dreams of where they want to live and how they want to relate to the land and relate to the water. And I think we need to think strategically about how to maintain or capture those qualities but strategically shift and move things and be proactive about our maintenance and infrastructure strategies.
But this whole idea of a strategic shift, it sort of runs at them in the face of a lot of those traditions Alex is talking about. Look, we just recently gave a whole lot of state money to one of the world's largest hedge funds to build a new headquarters on a pier out in the middle of Long Island Sound. If you look at the real estate listings, you will not see the prices of homes that are located in prime, pristine waterfront areas going down because of the risk of climate change and more floods. They seem to go up faster than the real estate in the rest of the world. And when we have homes just washed into the sea along the shoreline, people rush to build in the same spot. A lot of that doesn't feel strategic to me.
Right. It is somewhat haphazard, but it's... You know, you're really responding to, well, first of all, I'd like to kind of take a little bit of, thinking about what Alex said in terms of the Northeast. I would beg to differ. I do think that we've done a lot of great stuff here in Connecticut and as a partner and as a member state in New England and also joining arms with New York and New Jersey. But, you know, one of the key things that I think really brought it home for me was if we pay attention to some great bipartisan committees here in the state of Connecticut, the Climate Change and Shoreline Preservation Task Force, which has been chaired by Representative James Albus for over a year, they came out with a report back in December of 2011. And one of the key things that they mentioned in terms of a recommendation really tied into what you're talking about. This idea of personal or private property rights and the ability to do what you feel is appropriate to protect your assets, protect your family, and against how do your actions fit into the overall community. And there's one recommendation that's actually called out here to encourage shoreline neighborhoods and coalitions to act as a community and for individual citizens to really think about how their response and recovery post-events is really having an influence and potential impact on their neighbors. And so you're really directing our conversation here. One of the cruxes, I think, of the issue that will really make a difference longer term is how do we begin to think about this issue in terms of neighborhoods, in terms of communities, and across all of the communities in the state of Connecticut within the context of our council of governments and RPAs in the state.
Well, so what does that look like if we think in terms of communities, not just a built environment, Alex, but the way we decide to arrange ourselves as communities? What does it look like in a better constructed future, I suppose?
Well, I think we have to recognize that we've built in these areas and we have substantial infrastructure and development in coastal areas, much of it at risk. But we have to be strategic. So it's not a question of, you know, shifting out, moving people en masse. It's more a question of looking strategically along the coast. And what we've been thinking about is, you know, you can have one person on one side of the street who has a septic failure, and then across the street they might be out of the floodplain and face no real risk, except maybe both communities or both homeowners face the issue of repetitive floods on their roadways, so egress issues. So when you start thinking strategically about what the local considerations and concerns are, you start to realize that there are what we've been calling zones of shared risk, areas that have subpopulations that share similar risks. Rather than trying to clump together a whole group of different people that have different risks and different concerns and maybe even different beliefs, which I think is one of the challenges of this negotiation process, mm-hmm. That you can start to think and you know, clarify, well, these are concerns that you face. They're real. And they're adding up. And you know, if you look at long term planning and look at where we predict coastal sea level rise and storm events to occur, and we can look back at Sandy as precedent for that analysis, So, you know, what quality of science do you need to apply? Well, what we're finding in the land planning process when you think long term is let's look at a general assessment of what the risks are, what the flood potential is, and then start to identify solutions, possible solutions, which may mean buying somebody out, you know, at fair market value, for example, to identify a new egress that can alleviate some of the stress on the shoreline roadway system, for example. Or it may mean negotiating some kind of a community septic system or linking to potable water when you're now on wells. So the point is we have to get into the specifics. We have to work with people. We have to identify and develop a kind of collective learning process. Mm-hmm. And a process of engagement that can bring groups of people that are at multiple scales, including locals and townspeople and government officials, state and federal, towards solutions that make sense and that are efficient.
I want to get to some phone calls here at 860-275-7266. And there's a lot that we want to talk about out of this National Climate Assessment, but specifically around the local impacts. And we want to hear your stories about local impacts here in Connecticut at 860-275-7266 with Adam Welchel and Alexander Felsen. Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Hartford. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi. So I have about why the focus on climate change adaptation in the coastal areas, or that seems to be the primary issue. I work on the Park River Regional Watershed, which is the Hartford, West Hartford area. And, you know, a lot of people continue to move to the hinterlands in search of nature, and the state allows that. But, you know, there's big projects like the MDC Clean Water Project where improvements to infrastructure could also help revitalize our landscapes and create connectivity and healthy, beautiful landscapes in our urban areas within high-density zones. Where is the discussion about green infrastructure in Connecticut, in cities?
Thank you very much for the question. Well, it's probably right here because that's one of the things we wanted to talk about. So I'll turn to Alex perhaps first, but I'd like you both to weigh in on that.
Yeah, great question, and thanks for raising it. First, you know, I think coastal adaptation funding and the kind of process and all the energy that's going into coastal adaptation, which includes flood-prone areas. So we're talking about not just coastal but river systems. But you can also think about it in terms of green infrastructure, you know, and green infrastructure networks. I really think we need to take this as an opportunity to reimagine what our urban development can look like and how it can function from an ecosystem service perspective, because you know there are opportunities to develop near-term solutions. For example, we've been pushing a green infrastructure network strategy as a near-term solution, and if you overlay coastal future coastal predictions on those maps, you can actually develop long-term marsh migration systems. So it's really near-term green infrastructure, long-term coastal management, coastal adaptation. There's huge opportunities to rethink the hydrologic management systems that we have in our cities and to combine that with habitat connectivity. So I think thinking about stormwater chains, using funding that goes into DOT and other kinds of funding that is being currently paying for infrastructure, and coupling that with the hybrid green-gray infrastructure solutions that also function as public space networks as a critical next step for the urban environment.
Just for, when you say green-gray, what does that mean?
That means that, you know, right now we try to solve our infrastructure challenges like water management with concrete and kind of heavy infrastructure. There's movement towards developing or integrating green systems, bioswale systems, bioretention systems, other kinds of stormwater management components. And so you can start to combine those and actually find cost savings as long as you have land.
Yeah, and I think as we start to dive into some of the results coming out of this Northeast National Climate Assessment, that the key things in terms of thinking about urban communities like Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport is really, you know, honing in on this extreme precipitation event. You know, these events can really overwhelm our wastewater treatment facilities and really, you know, create some degradation into our local waters and rivers and streams, not just the coastline. And then heat. You know, the combination of heat and the number of days we're looking at it towards mid-century of something like 50 days over 90 degrees, and we're sitting at between 10 and 20 now, and the disproportionate impact that will have on health, increased visits to emergency rooms, thinking about our at-risk communities, elderly, poor, sick, you know, and really looking at those issues that are only going to get compounded as we go forward. And, you know, I've had the good fortune through our Coast Resilience program and our community resilience workshops to engage with inland communities. So, you know, the issues may be a little bit different in terms of it's not storm surge, it's not sea level rise, but there are certainly impacts, and we need to be really sensitive to that as we all strive to find a solution to this and come up with resilient approaches, as Alex indicated.
We are going to be talking about the effects of heat and water, certainly not just water along the shoreline, but increased precipitation events. We're going to move the conversation a little bit to infectious disease. We're also going to be talking more about resilient cities. And we want to hear your stories about local impacts, what you think we should be thinking about around climate change, around this national climate assessment. 860-275-7266. We're joined today by Adam Welchel from the Nature Conservancy and Alexander Felsen from Yale's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. We're going to take a break. When we come back, more of your phone calls and more conversation about climate change where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're teaming up with the Colin McEnroe Show to discuss climate change. Coming up at 1 o'clock and then again at 8 p.m., Colin will be joined by a panel of local meteorologists to talk about the local weather changes that we're seeing and some of their ideas about that. Today we're talking about climate change and adaptation. We're talking about some of the local climate impacts that we're seeing right now. We're taking your calls at 860-275-7266. Our guests are Adam Welchel from the Nature Conservancy and the Coastal Resilience Network. Alexander Felsen is here. He's from Yale's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies and also the Yale School of Architecture. Your call's in a moment at 860-275-7266. Just quickly on this idea that you brought up about heat, the increased heat, especially in urban areas, it has this terrible cyclical effect in which things warm up and we have to cool down. So we burn more energy to try to cool things down, especially at peak demand. And then when we do that, we tend to burn the most inefficient things to try to meet that peak demand. We seem to, Adam, have put ourselves in a really terrible cycle in the Northeast, especially in the way we deal with extreme heat events.
Yeah, I think it's important to put Connecticut in the context of our surrounding areas. So one of the things that the Northeast report points out is that Connecticut actually sits in the highest density urban corridor in North America. If we're looking from Washington up to Boston, we're looking at 48 million people that, you know, with projections of 18 million more by 2050 or so, all depending on the electric grid, all depending on infrastructure, roads, rail, wastewater treatment facilities, as we mentioned. And so when you multiply that by this increase in heat, you know, heat waves, number of days over 90, it puts a lot of stress on our existing energy grid, and the demand goes way up. And so, but the added implications of both heat combined with changes in air quality in our urban environments really can have a devastating impact on, again, the at-risk communities. You know, and I grew up in Colebrook, Connecticut, which is way up in the northwest corner. And I can tell you, we never had to worry about air conditioning in rural environments. And I think this report really pulls it out. It's not just an urban issue. This increase in heat and heat waves is also going to be a rural issue, particularly in communities that have never had to consider air conditioning.
Of course, in Colebrook, Connecticut, there's a big fight over wind generation. Yeah. And what happens when people try to build sustainable energy in somebody's backyard? But you know what? That's maybe another conversation.
Yeah, I'm not going to go
there
with you.
For another time. Well, let's go to another piece of this conversation and bring in Derlin Fish, who's a professor of epidemiology and of forestry and environmental studies at Yale University. He's going to join us by the phone for a moment. And welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us. Hi, Derlin Fish. Are you there?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to bring you in because one of the things that we were talking about just now is the increase in water in our environment, certainly through heavy rainfall events, and the increase in heat. That could very well mean more mosquito-borne illnesses, and that's one of the things you're looking at. What can you tell us about the ways in which we're adapting or looking at more mosquito-borne or other infectious diseases because of climate change?
Well, I'm afraid I can't tell you much about adapting because we really don't know what the risks are, how climate change is going to influence mosquito and tick populations is a very good question. You know, I get asked every year, you know, if there's been a wet spring or a cold winter, everyone asks, are there going to be more mosquitoes this year? Are there going to be more ticks this year? And, you know, I can only guess, because I can't really cite any specific studies that have been done that would provide an answer. So, unfortunately, in this field of infectious diseases, particularly insect-borne infectious diseases, we're really decades behind the other disciplines. We can't talk about adaptation because we don't know what to expect.
But that seems surprising. Why are we so far behind, given the rise of many infectious diseases around the world over the course of the last couple decades, and given the very real possibility that as temperatures rise and as weather conditions change, we are going to see different infectious disease patterns as well?
Well, there are other priorities in infectious diseases. People spend a lot of money, or people, the government particularly, spends a lot of money developing vaccines and diagnostics and therapeutics. And that research, unfortunately, has no relevance in terms of, you know, environmental factors affecting disease transmission. We don't have a lot of money to study those kinds of relationships. So, you know, I don't know, you know, are we going to take money away from vaccine development to fund climate change studies? And it's a decision somebody else has to make.
Well, Adam Welchel, maybe we can just talk about this for a moment, because I think that this might be a very important thing as we're looking at adaptation, human health and how it's effective. We talked about some of the very specific examples. Yes, if there's flooding along a coastline, mm-hmm. it can affect human health. Yes, if we have days over 100 degrees, the sick and the elderly are endangered. But if there's a rise in infectious disease, which seems fairly likely, at least a change in it, given what you're talking about, why aren't we spending more effort, energy, money there?
Geez, John. well, you know, I think we, again, we have to take it in context. And Alex had raised this before, the previous guest just mentioned this. Our guest. This issue poses some significant challenges for society writ large, right? And the costs are tremendous. You know, looking at impacts on wastewater treatment, just for example, we're looking at billions and billions and billions of dollars, and the state certainly is directing a great deal of money towards not only getting those systems better managed and folks trained, and also thinking building in sea level rise to resilience and those kind of things. But it's such a huge challenge that there just isn't enough money to go around, perhaps, is really the answer there.
Yeah, I'll add to that. I think the concern that Dr. Fish is raising in terms of infectious diseases and the ecological knowledge or the scientific understanding of those systems is actually something that is of concern for the whole construction industry. Certainly the kind of best management practices that we've been pushing forward for our coastal environments and for flood-prone areas are not very well assessed in terms of their performance, in terms of their contribution as ecosystem services, in terms of their long-term maintenance. Not something that I necessarily like to admit, because this is the field that I am, you know, staking my career on. But you know, there you can look at something like green infrastructure, the notion of developing stormwater chains through an urban environment. You're talking about more water, you know, more networks of water, which could lead to increased mosquito production, for example, which might have implications on disease vectors. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why they treated marshes the way they did early and developed a mosquito ditching in marsh systems. So it's a very serious concern. And I think it falls into the category of urban ecology, understanding urban ecosystems and engaging the scientific community more readily and providing the incentives and the opportunities and the funding to position them to analyze and assess these kinds of ecosystems.
Derlin Fish, I'll just ask you, a very specific local personal example on this. You know, I don't want the stormwater runoff that comes off of the roof of my barn to go out into the street and just roll down into the drain. So I put it into a storm barrel, and I use that to water my plants later. The problem is that water builds up over time, and it clearly brings more mosquitoes into my neighborhood. I mean, just from a personal level, is that the sort of thing I should be worried about? I'm trying to do one good thing for the environment for my local community. And on the other hand, I may very well be bringing in disease-carrying agents right into my backyard.
Well, you're perfectly correct. You know, unfortunately, there's very little cross-disciplinary effort, in trying to bring in infectious disease and epidemiology into these environmental kinds of studies. I mean, when they do like wetlands restoration or water management projects, there's really no requirement to consider any impact on mosquito production and the potential for mosquito-borne disease. That's not even a consideration, and we've gotten ourselves in a lot of trouble by changing things unwittingly and winding up with an infectious disease problem.
Derlin Fish is professor of epidemiology and of forestry and environmental studies at Yale University. Thanks so much for adding to the conversation. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
You can join us at 860-275-7266. A lot of people do want to get involved in this conversation, so let's go to Bernice in Tolland. Hi, Bernice.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. What's on your mind?
Well, I've got just a few points to bring up. What effect is this climate change going to have on people who live near watershed areas like lakes, and then the deforestation near these lakes, people who want to cut the trees down so they can look at the lakes? And what about the well water that they're using and the insect population near the watershed areas? And then the loss of power from, the trees falling down in these areas.
I'll tell you what. What I'm going to do, Bernice, is I'm going to stop you there just because I want to get a few answers from our experts. But thank you very much because you raise a lot of interesting points. First of all, she talks about watershed areas, the lakes, the beautiful lakes and reservoirs that we have here. Climate change impact that you see here in the Northeast.
Yeah. I think one of the key things here, and you mentioned a whole bunch of stuff, and I think it really surfaces the complexity and the comprehensive nature of this issue. And so, one of the things that we do with my program, through our community resilience workshops, is we get the entire community together. It's really about a comprehensive discussion to get all of these impacts that are today and lean forward a little bit and think about future, and really hone in on coming up with some meaningful solutions that are useful and usable and really have meaning for the community that tackle this watershed deforestation, lake communities. I can tell you that a lot of the communities that I've worked with, where you have dam structures that are somehow regulating the amount of water back in a reservoir or an impoundment, there's ideas about dewatering that reservoir in advance of a major storm, so you have that storage capacity and preventing flooding downstream to people and property. So, there's ways to think about that. The electricity question that you raised is obviously something that is a whole different suite of actors, but they need, first and foremost, it needs to be approached from a comprehensive perspective, and that's the kind of thing that we do in Connecticut.
Well, I think to a second part of her question, they're talking about the trees. We got an email from Francis that goes to that from West Hartford, who writes, people all around me are taking down their huge maple trees because they worry about hurricanes blowing the trees down and onto their homes. And this is, of course, something we've heard about, the power companies doing a lot of cutting, the state of Connecticut trying to cut down a lot of trees. She continues, I'm trying to hold on to my big maples for the shade they provide. So Francis wants to keep the maples up, especially thinking about rising temperatures and also for the way they contribute to air quality. So who's right on this one, Alex? I mean, this is another one of these either-or questions. We're both trying to do the right thing, right? So what do you say?
Well, okay, I think the caller sort of hit the nail on the head in the email. There are co-benefits, there are trade-offs, and there are compromises. And these we call these problems kind of wicked problems. They're seriously challenging and confusing issues, and we're looking for information, often scientific information, to answer these questions. Ultimately, the scientific community has interest in some of these, in many of these variables, but it's actually a shared concern. It's a shared issue. The public and the science community and the government all share a lot of uncertainty around these issues and recognize or face the compromises. So, I think we need to I think this is an opportunity to rethink how we are designing urban environments and to develop innovative new landscape typologies and conditions. For example, we've been looking in my lab at windrows and the idea of developing rather than this individual street tree or individual trees, that you start to think about where you can develop clumped tree plantings, which don't really have an issue in terms of falling trees, but they can create control and deal with some of the wind flow and wind issues and wind risk. So if you start thinking about how to restructure landscape, and maybe this means homeowners collectively working together to develop these systems in their backyards and shifting the lawn to more functional ecological communities, That could both reduce fertilizer inputs that are creating all these downstream issues and also create a kind of public amenity and a kind of collective garden.
But let's talk about I think these are great ideas, but let's talk about the reality of this, because, you know, we talked early on in this conversation about some of the traditions of the Northeast. One of the traditions of the Northeast is local control. That extends to the town level of government. It extends to somebody's backyard. I have the right to do in my yard what I want. And maybe even there's a homeowners association that will say what you can and can't do. But for the most part, people like to know what they can do in their own backyard. Town by town, we have the same problem, Adam, where every single town in the state has to have their own plan for adaptation, for how to get out of an emergency. But yet somehow or other, they don't always work together. And that's not terribly surprising. How do we get people to think in this slightly more collective way, if indeed we need to help mitigate some of these problems?
Well, there's no doubt that we need to be thinking collectively and working across town boundaries. Can I say that again?
Yeah.
and I think one of the undervalued assets, if I could frame it that way, in the state of Connecticut are our council of governments, our regional planning agencies. And they really serve as a hub. Oftentimes they're very focused in providing services and expertise that really are needed in municipalities, and you know, often they're geared towards finding funding and things of that nature. But the collaborative kind of hub is something we desperately need to strengthen here in Connecticut, and you know, it's going to require some creative and innovative thinking in this 21st century. We can't escape this. I mean, going back to this idea that it's not if, it's now. I kind of like that. But it's, we have to be thinking as a community. It's an imperative, and we go back to that, and I've seen it happen through our workshop process, and what is it, 1,000 hands make lighter work? You know, those kind of concepts, and we've got a great tradition. And I mean, think back to the turn of the century; we completely deforested the entire state. That takes a lot of grit. That takes a lot of backbone to do. You know, if we start thinking about applying that to making our state greener and more resilient and energy efficient and sort of blending this idea of sustainability with resilience and really being a model for the future, I think we can do it. I know we can. We're from Connecticut.
Well, let's just see. We want to maybe get to one more quick phone call before our break. Actually, what we're going to do is take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the other local impacts here. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're talking about climate change, the National Climate Assessment, what it means here in the Northeast with our guests in studio. We're also taking your phone calls. We're going to hear a little story from Vermont about how it's impacting the Green Mountain State. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, Dan Brown has written some of the biggest blockbusters in literature history, from The Da Vinci Code to his latest book, Inferno. He's coming to Hartford next month to talk with me at the Bushnell in an event for the Mark Twain House. We will preview that conversation tomorrow. We'll also talk about the last American whaling ship. It set sail once again from Mystic Seaport this last weekend. We're going to talk with a local writer who will be a voyager on the Charles W. Morgan. I hope that you can join us on the next Where We Live. Today we're talking about climate change and local adaptations. Adam Welchel is Director of Science for the Nature Conservancy, who's also a lead author on the Northeast section of the U.S. National Climate Assessment. Alexander Felsen is an urban ecologist and assistant professor in Yale's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. We're going to take some more of your phone calls here before we change to talking about Vermont and some of the impacts in the Green Mountain State. Carol's in Columbia. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's up?
I have an envelope house here in Columbia. My husband and I, friends and family, built it 33 years ago. It has no furnace in it, and we can keep it warm with 3/4 of a cord of wood. And by warm, I mean 76 to 82 degrees with the help of the sun and the heat that comes from the ground under the foundation. Lucy Nell Potancio was out here a few years ago and did an article on it, and you can Google it on Envelope House Columbia CT.
I remember this story quite well. I remember working on that with Lucy. It's a fascinating thing. Actually, what we'll do is we'll put up a link to that story on our website, WNPR.org, so people can learn a little bit more. Carol, thanks for sharing that story. And Alex, you can talk a little bit about this, because this is one of the many building ideas that I think people have out there.
Yeah, well, I'll use this as an opportunity to argue for the importance of having homeowners and the public participate in this kind of experimentation and adaptation. We, Derlin mentioned the need for more science. a kind of collective approach where people are building these kind of homes and trying new things and innovating is a critical aspect of climate change coastal adaptation. We need more people doing this kind of work. We need that information to get out into the public. Those things, if they're adaptive and you can show where failures are as well as successes, you can start to really help the larger community solve these kinds of problems.
Roy is in Guilford. Hi, Roy. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. Yes, I have a couple of questions. I was wondering about the role of the federal flood insurance has played in real estate development along the shore. I know that here in Guilford, when I was a kid, along the shore, were all just little cottages that I suppose could be blown down and rebuilt relatively inexpensively. And now you have many, many very expensive homes. You have mansions. Some are on rocks. One set of them is accessible by a road that is literally at sea level through a marsh. And I'm just wondering about the role, the extent to which federal flood insurance has enabled that construction, the degree to which all of us as taxpayers subsidize it, and what changes, if any, you think should be made to that program.
Roy, great questions. Thank you very much. Who'd like to tackle that?
Sure, I will. This is Adam. Yeah, I think this program has been around for a long time. It's in a bit of trouble right now. It's about $24 billion in debt at this point due to the big event, Sandy, and sort of building off Katrina back in 2005. So, yeah, there's no doubt that it's referred to as a subsidy program. Really, it's providing low-cost risk for coastal and river residents that are in special flood hazard areas. It's meant to ease the pain, if you will, in terms of living in those areas. But it's very costly for the U.S. taxpayer. Just a quick stat, taxpayers in the U.S. are responsible for, via the National Flood Insurance Program, about $510 billion in insured assets. That's just along the coast. So that's the portfolio that we have risk that we haven't inherited as U.S. taxpayers based on decisions to supplement and subsidize risk along the coast and along rivers. So it's a very touchy subject. There was a big bill last summer, Biggert's Water, and there's been a revision that has repealed a lot of the startling and ground shaking kind of changes that were in the bill last year. But reform of National Flood Insurance Program will be something that will come up again and again because it's expensive. And, people in Colebrook are being asked to foot the bill for folks living down in where you are in Guilford.
Well, and one of the things that we want to turn to is because we've had a lot of conversation about the direct shoreline that we have here in Connecticut, but we want to turn a little bit to what happens in inland areas, the effects of some of the big storms the last few years. We didn't expect them to hit places like Vermont as hard as they did, but, of course, Vermont was nearly destroyed in a terrible rainstorm a few years back. Their governor, Peter Shumlin, has been talking about this. And I want to bring in David Zuckerman, who's a Vermont state senator. He's also a farmer at Full Moon Farm in Hinesburg, Vermont. Senator, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity.
So how is Vermont adapting to these all of these climate changes, specifically given the terrible flooding that you had a few years ago?
Well, I'm no expert, but I know that our transportation department and our natural resources folks worked closely in the rebuilding after what was then the remnants of Hurricane Irene. We got it as a tropical storm, but you're right. We got about 10 to 12 inches of rain in some areas. And they've put larger culverts in and various sort of infrastructure improvements so that you don't get some of the clogged up scenarios that created some of the flooding. But really, in my opinion, that's a lot of the triage method and planning for the sort of bad scenes of the future in a road infrastructure way, but we haven't done as much of the, individual adjustments that I think both Vermonters and folks all across the country need to start doing to see if we can slow it at least some, even if at this point it's going to happen.
I'm wondering if you can talk about the agricultural impacts. You're a farmer yourself. Talk about how it's impacted some of the things that people grow in Vermont and how you're trying to adapt there.
Well, we grow, for instance, sweet potatoes now, and I don't think 20 or 30 years ago anybody thought of growing sweet potatoes in Vermont. We have a long enough and warm enough season in the summer that some of those crops are more viable than they used to be. We've also, it feels to me, and I've only been farming for 15 or 20 years, so that's not that long in the world of farming, but that there's stronger winds. We seem to get frequent 20, 30, 40 mile an hour winds almost once a week or every couple weeks. And at least from a farming perspective, we have a lot of high tunnels, plastic structures in Vermont that are, you know, greenhouse-like. And those things take a beating, as do the row cover that we put on crops. I don't know if people drive by farms that much in Connecticut, but there's a white cover that you might see on some crops in the field. It's a very thin spiderweb-like material, and it just gets ripped off the fields or torn up, which means you got to put it back down, and that's a lot of cost in human labor. So some crop changes, some just straight labor effects. And then we've gotten stronger storms. It seems like instead of a long, showery day, we get these bands of thunderstorms. And those heavier drops and more pounding rains tend to do more erosion. They tend not to soak in as deep. So those are some of the types of changes of what we see.
Kim had emailed us. She wanted to know what we're doing for animals around climate change. How are they affected, and what are we doing to help them? David Zuckerman, I wanted to put this to you. For people who are dairy farmers or grow other animals on farms, it seems as though that might be another adaptation. What do you say to Kim?
Well, it's interesting. We took some testimony at the State House on this, and some of the dairy farmers were actually glad that the season was getting longer. Some of them were getting four cuts of hay instead of three off the field, which got them better yield. That's not necessarily how it's impacting the animals, but how it is impacting some of the dairy farms. On the other hand, dairy cows don't do well in super high heat. And Vermont, while I'm not a dairy farmer, Vermont is primarily still a dairy agricultural sector. So some of the farmers are having to do more to help cool their animals. I actually heard recently that in Florida, all the animals are indoors and they have air conditioning and misting of water on those cows. So I don't know if that's the future in Vermont, but when it gets more humid and gets really hot, actually milk production does go down. So I'm sure farmers will be adjusting their cooling systems in their barns.
Senator, before I let you go, I got to ask, are we in trouble with maple syrup in Vermont?
Well, the season started very late this year. One guy I talked to said we got a really lucky 8-10 day spell that got him back up to about 80% of his normal production. Vermont doubled its production in the last 10 years. People are throwing taps in the trees like crazy because the syrup is demand is growing. But they do say in, you know, 50 to 100 years, the climate is going to move the maple trees farther north, and Vermont will have more of a Virginia or, in a worst-case scenario, Georgia-like climate, and we wouldn't have the maple trees. But I think for you and me, we're going to be okay, but our grandkids, looks like we're going to be buying a lot of Quebec syrup.
David Zuckerman, Vermont State Senator and a farmer at Full Moon Farm in Hinesburg, Vermont. Thank you so much for joining us, Senator. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks. Thank you as well.
Hey, look, we just have about a minute left in this conversation, but I just want to quickly ask our guest, Adam Welchel. Look, we just heard from him some impacts on the ground, but some impacts that could be seen as positives. You can mm-hmm. grow different things in Vermont mm-hmm. with higher winds. That might be bad in one way, but maybe you can use more wind power down the way. Is part of our adaptation plan looking at the things that are happening that we can capture as opposed to just the things that we're going to hold off?
That's exactly right. I think what this report calls out is that it helps us, you know, the future favors those that can actually see it. And I think this report helps to provide some clarity there. And we do need to be focusing on our strengths because, you know, these challenges are big. We need to be optimistic. And I think one of the key things that we haven't quite covered in this conversation is our strengths, our natural infrastructure, our natural resources, and paying attention to the fact that floodplains, wetlands, intact forests can actually keep us safe, to help keep us safe. And they also have co-benefits. They clean our water. They clean our air. And so paying attention to those natural resources and the other strengths, the ingenuity, the people power that we have in the Northeast is phenomenal, and that's another strength we need to capture.
I'll give you a last word, Alex.
Thank you. Yeah, building on what Adam's saying with Rebuild by Design, a federal competition where we worked on Resilient Bridgeport, we were using coastal adaptation funding to redevelop the Long Island Sound fishery industry, the aquaculture industry. So the idea would be, can you direct some of that funding towards developing production in the coast?
What we want to do is put up on our website, WNPR.org, more about that project. I want to thank Alex Felsen and Adam Welchel. This is Where We Live.